The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo. Continuing with Part 3, The Yoga of Divine Love, Chapter 2, The Motives of Devotion. So far, then, all yogic experience is agreed. But religion and the yoga of bhakti go farther. They attribute to this being a personality and human relations with the human being. In both, the human being approaches the divine by means of his humanity, with human emotions, as he would approach a fellow being, but with more intense and exalted feelings. And not only so, but the divine also responds in a manner answering to these emotions. In that possibility of response lies the whole question. For if the divine is impersonal, featureless, and relationless, no such response is possible. And all human approach to it becomes an absurdity. We must rather dehumanize, depersonalize, annul ourselves insofar as we are human beings, or any kind of beings, on no other conditions and by no other means can we approach it. Love, fear, prayer, praise, worship of an impersonality which has no relation with us or with anything in the universe and no feature that our minds can lay hold of are obviously an irrational foolishness. On such terms, religion and devotion become out of the question. The Advaitin, in order to find a religious basis for his bare and sterile philosophy, has to admit the practical existence of God and the gods, and to delude his mind with the language of Maya. Buddhism only became a popular religion when Buddha had taken the place of the supreme deity as an object of worship. Even if the supreme be capable of relations with us, but only of impersonal relations, religion is robbed of its human vitality, and the path of devotion ceases to be effective or even possible. Even if the Supreme be capable of relations with us, but only of impersonal relations, religion is robbed of its human vitality, and the path of devotion ceases to be effective or even possible. We may indeed apply our human emotions to it, but in a vague and imprecise fashion, with no hope of a human response. The only way in which it can respond to us is by stilling our emotions and throwing upon us its own impersonal calm and immutable equality. And this is what in fact happens when we approach the pure impersonality of the Godhead. We can obey it as a law, lift our souls to it in aspiration, towards its tranquil being, grow into it by shedding from us our emotional nature. The human being in us is not satisfied, but is quieted, balanced, stilled. But the yoga of devotion, agreeing in this with religion, insists on a closer and warmer worship than this impersonal aspiration. It aims at a divine fulfillment of the humanity in us, as well as of the impersonal part of our being. It aims at a divine satisfaction of the emotional being of man. It demands of the Supreme acceptance of our love and a response in kind, as we delight in him and seek him, so it believes that he too delights in us and seeks us. Nor can this demand be condemned as irrational. For if the supreme and universal being did not take any delight in us, it is not easy to see how we could have come into being or could remain in being. And if he does not at all draw us towards him, a divine seeking of us, there would seem to be no reason in nature why we should turn from the round of our normal existence to seek him. Therefore, that there may be at all any possibility of a yoga of devotion, we must assume first that the supreme existence is not an abstraction or a state of existence, but a conscious being. Secondly, that he meets us in the universe and is in some way immanent in it as well as its source. Otherwise, we should have to go out of cosmic life to meet him. Thirdly, that he is capable of personal relations with us and must therefore be not incapable of personality. Finally, that when we approach him by our human emotions, we receive a response in kind. This does not mean that the nature of the divine is precisely the same as our human nature, though upon a larger scale, or that it is that nature pure, of certain perversions, and God a magnified, or else an ideal man. God is not and cannot be an ego limited by his qualities as we are in our normal consciousness. But on the other hand, our human consciousness must certainly originate and have been derived from the divine. Though the forms which it takes in us may and must be other than the divine because we are limited by ego, not universal, not superior to our nature, not greater than our qualities and their workings. As he is, still our human emotions and impulses must have behind them a truth in him, of which they are the limited, and very often, therefore, the perverse, or even the degraded forms. By approaching him through our emotional being, we approach that truth. It comes down to us to meet our emotions and lift them towards it. Through it, our emotional being is united with him. Secondly, this supreme being is also the universal being, and our relations with the universe are all means by which we are prepared for entering into relation with him. All the emotions with which we confront the action of the universal existence upon us are really directed towards him, in ignorance at first, but it is by directing them in growing knowledge towards him that we enter into more intimate relations with him. And all that is false and ignorant in them will fall away as we draw nearer towards unity. To all of them he answers, taking us in the stage of progress in which we are. For if we met no kind of response or help to our imperfect approach, the more perfect relations could never be established. Even as men approach him, so he accepts them, and responds, too, by the divine love to their bhakti. Tathaiva bhajate. Whatever form of being, whatever qualities they lend to him, through that form and those qualities, he helps them to develop, encourages or governs their advance, and in their straight way or they're crooked, draws them towards him. What they see of him is a truth, but a truth represented to them in the terms of their own being and consciousness, partially, distortedly, not in the terms of its own higher reality, not in the aspect which it assumes when we become aware of the complete divinity. This is the justification of the cruder and more primitive elements of religion, and also their sentence of transience and passing. They are justified because there is a truth of the divine behind them, and only so could that truth of the divine be approached in that stage of the developing human consciousness and be helped forward. They are condemned because to persist always in these crude conceptions and relations with the divine is to miss that closer union towards which these crude beginnings are the first steps, however faltering. All life, we have said, is a yoga of nature. Here in this material world, life is her reaching out from her first inconscience towards a return to union with the conscient divine from whom she proceeded. In religion, the mind of man, her accomplished instrument, becomes aware of her goal in him, responds to her aspiration. Even popular religion is a sort of ignorant yoga of devotion. But it does not become what we specifically call yoga until the motive becomes, in a certain degree, clairvoyant. Until it sees that union is its object, and that love is the principle of union. And until, therefore, it tries to realize love and lose its separative character in love. When that has been accomplished, then the yoga has taken its decisive step and is sure of its fruition. Thus, the motives of devotion have first to direct themselves engrossingly and predominantly towards the divine, then to transform themselves so that they are rid of their more earthly elements, and finally to take their stand in pure and perfect love. All those that cannot coexist with the perfect union of love must eventually fall away, while only those that conform themselves into expressions of divine love and into means of enjoying divine love can remain. For love is the one emotion in us which can be entirely motiveless and self-existent. Love need have no other motive than love. For all our emotions arise either from the seeking after delight and the possession of it, or from the baffling of the search, or from the failure of the delight we have possessed or had thought to grasp. But love is that by which we can enter directly into possession of the self-existent delight of the divine being. Divine love is indeed itself that possession and, as it were, the body of the Ananda. These are the truths which condition our approach to this yoga and our journey on this path. There are subsidiary questions which arise and trouble the intellect of man, but though we may have yet to deal with them, they are not essential. Yoga of bhakti is a matter of the heart and not of the intellect. For even for the knowledge which comes on in this way, we set out from the heart and not from the intelligence. the truth of the motives of the heart's devotion, and their final arrival, and in some sort their disappearance into the supreme and unique self-existent motive of love, is therefore all that initially and essentially concerns us. Such difficult questions there are as whether the divine has an original supraphysical form or power of form from which all forms proceed, or is eternally formless. All we need at present say is that the divine does at least accept the various forms which the devotee gives to him, and through them meets him in love, while the mixing of our spirits with his spirit is essential to the fruition of bhakti. So, too, certain religions and religious philosophies seek to bind down devotion by a conception of an eternal difference between the human soul and the divine, without which, they say, love and devotion cannot exist. While that philosophy which considers that one alone exists consigns love and devotion to a movement in the ignorance, necessary perhaps for the least useful as a preparatory movement while yet the ignorance lasts. But impossible when all difference is abolished and therefore to be transcended and discarded. We may hold, however, the truth of the one existence in this sense that all in nature is the divine, even though God be more than all in nature, and love becomes then a movement by which the divine in nature and man takes possession of and enjoys the delight of the universal and the supreme divine. In any case, love has necessarily a twofold fulfillment by its very nature, that by which the lover and the beloved enjoy their union in difference, and all too that enhances the joy of various union, and that by which they throw themselves into each other and become one self. That truth is quite sufficient to start with, for it is the very nature of love. And since love is the essential motive of this yoga, as is the whole nature of love, so will be too the crown and fulfillment of the movement of the yoga. And thus ends chapter 2, The Motives of Divine Love. And thus ends chapter 2, The Motives of Devotion, page 560.